before I came here, I spent some time in Southern Africa. I went there right after seminary for a few months, and then went back three times after that, leading travel seminars for the American Lutheran Church. I was working in the World Mission Office for the American Lutheran Church, and got very interested in a lot of the Southern Africa advocacy issues going on in this country. Worked a lot on the ALC's Free Namibia emphasis, and have come to really love and care about the South African people that I met and know, and I'm fascinated by the whole church situation in Southern Africa, and that's especially what we're going to be looking at today. And it is, the title of the session is The Church Struggle in South Africa, because it truly is a church struggle. It's obviously very political as well, and social, economic, everything else, but the churches are very much involved, partly because the apartheid system in South Africa grows out of a faith, an understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ that we believe is heretical, but which nonetheless is founded in scripture, and because the churches are one of the two, I would say, most hopeful agents for possible nonviolent change in South Africa right now, the other one being the labor unions. And so I think it is really important to look at the church in Southern Africa when we're struggling to understand what's going on there. Are you looking for the wilderness session or the Africa one? This is Africa here. And the wilderness is next door. Okay, great. We had to switch rooms. So what I want to do is start by showing some slides just to give a flavor of the country. There will also be some Namibia slides in there because I think Namibia is a very, very important issue for those of us who are American Christians. Very clear-cut one also. And then mention some other stuff about the church and about the country, and then open it up for discussion. I know probably most of you certainly have heard a lot about Southern Africa and are interested in the issue and probably have opinions of your own, and I really want to hear those also. So it'll be kind of experiential. And the other qualification I want to add is that the last time I was there was now more than a year ago, in March of 1986, with a bishop's trip from bishops from the American Lutheran Church and a number of other church leaders. Things are happening really fast in South Africa, and so a lot of my information is already out of date, even though it's just been a little over a year since I was there. But I've tried to stay fairly current in reading and stuff like that, and I'll finish also by recommending some resources to you that you can get in our bookstore. Okay, first of all, to say this is kind of a dark slide, but South Africa is a land of incredible beauty. If you don't see anything else, you're very, very struck by the geography there. Spectacular country, and also really beautiful people. Population of about 29 million, 28.8 million or so, 29 million people, of whom just under 5 million are white, and the rest, the other 24 million are black, colored, and Asian. And they really do group people into those various classifications. Everyone is classified under the terms of the Population Registration Act, and the races are, in many, many ways, kept separate. The second thing besides the geographical beauty that really struck me is the incredible vitality of the church. I would say that I experienced a sort of conversion or definitely a renewal in my own Christian faith by visiting churches in Southern Africa. I was so impressed by the worship life, the prayer life, the depth of faith that people exhibit, the commitment, the ministry that's going on. It was really moving, and I feel that, you know, you look for places on earth where the kingdom of God seems to be dawning, where God's presence really is felt, and I would say Southern Africa is one of those today. Very, very exciting to see the church, to worship with South African sisters and brothers. The communion services that we were a part of were really moving as we became a part of the body of Christ some 10,000 miles away from here, sharing the bread and wine with those people. And this was probably the most moving of all, was a communion service we had that was presided over by this man in white here, Dean Simon Ferrisani, who's a Lutheran pastor in the nominally independent homeland of Venda, one of those sort of puppet homelands. And he has been one of the most outspoken critics of apartheid of any church leaders, and has really suffered for that. In 1981 and several times since then, he's been imprisoned and tortured. Most recently, he was in prison, I think beginning in October, November of 86, and just released this spring in March, I think it was, after a lot of pressure and letters from American Christians and Christians from all over the world, the Venda government finally released him. And he's been an amazing person, an amazing witness to the power of nonviolence, to the power of love of one's enemies. He's active in Amnesty International, active in working for reconciliation as well as for just change in South Africa. He also baptized a baby, three babies that day. It's really neat to see. And it was a real privilege to be with him and his wife for the weekend and to learn about their struggle. This is the police headquarters at Sibasa in Venda, where he was tortured for a number of months in 1981. He took us to see that. He had an incredible sense of humor. He would drive us all around sort of taunting and laughing at what he'd been through, but it obviously pained him very much. And it didn't silence him in any way. He's still very outspoken. South Africa is all about today the incredible division and violence that's present everywhere in the country. South Africa is truly a land divided. Out of the population of 29 million, the 5 million or so white people live in relative affluence. And I keep using the words relative because it really is that relative affluence, a standard of living much like our own. This is a nice hotel in downtown Windhoek in Namibia, Kalahari Sands. This is a German-speaking white Lutheran church in Namibia, and it's saddest of all to see apartheid in the churches, but it really is there, especially in the Lutheran church. Probably the most racially segregated church, topped only by the Dutch Reformed Church, but the Lutheran church is very much divided. Side by side and yet separated from the relative affluence from the whites is a relative poverty of blacks in southern Africa. And these next few pictures are from the township of Crossroads outside of Cape Town, which is probably the most famous black township. It's now been effectively at least half demolished, and the government, of course, is trying to demolish the rest of it. But many blacks are resisting that. The reason people want to live there is because it's close into the city. You can see it's located just behind the airport there. I think this is one of the more incongruous of the slides, but you can see the shacks here of Crossroads, and right overhead a South African Airways jetliner is just landing there on the runway behind those trees. In Crossroads, there's no running water to each home. The sewage system is terrible, bad drinking water. Very typical of the black townships, the crowding. Those blacks who are not fortunate enough to live in cities or in townships are relegated to the homelands where conditions are even worse. This is the drinking water system in one of the homelands fairly close to Johannesburg, within 100 miles of Johannesburg, so some people commute each day from this homeland into the city to work. The infant mortality rate in the homelands is close to 50% before the age of 5, which is really bad. We visited a number of cemeteries, probably the most moving place that we visited on any of our trips. Everybody was weeping by the time we left this seminary because you see just row after row after row after row of children's graves. Hardly any adults buried there, it's all children. And these little tiny graves. This is a particularly fancy gravestone here. Is that in focus? Let me see.
Yeah, that's good.
Is that good? Okay. Yeah. This is unusually fancy, but I took this picture because you can read the dates on it. Rosina Macheke was born in 1962 and died in 1967 at the age of 5. Very typical. The sanitation and health care in the homelands is poor, and almost half the kids die before they reach the age of 5. Now also the township violence, the police violence against blacks, has been heavily directed against children and young people. It's estimated that half, more than half the people in detention since the state of emergency that was declared in 1985 are young people under the age of 18. So it's really hitting hard on children and young people, the whole present situation. You also see some of this, although less than before. I've noticed each time I've gone, it's a little less of the segregated park benches, bathrooms, that kind of thing. Blankies is the Afrikaner word for whites. And so this is a white women's bathroom. It's twice as hard to go to the bathroom in public places in South Africa because you not only have to get the right gender, you have to get the right racial group here. And this would be the bathroom for women who are blacks, coloreds, and Asians.
What would happen to you if you used one of those?
Well, it would be easier for a white person to use a black bathroom than vice versa, people do it. There's that kind of civil disobedience going on all the time. You get frowned at, spit upon, harassed. And this, you can tell my slides are really out of date. This is the hated passbook or reference book that has been one of the backbones, one of the four, they call them pillars of the apartheid system, which include the Population Registration Act, the Group Areas Act, the PASS laws, and the Mixed Marriages Act. The PASS laws were abolished last year, but most blacks, including Pastor Farisani, who I talked with, well, I guess I haven't talked with him that recently, but read something by, most blacks feel that things really have not changed. The PASS laws have simply been replaced by the Orderly Urbanization Act and an identity card system. But anyway, this was the document that governed everyone's life. Your pass had to have a certain stamp in it if you wanted to move to the city, if you wanted to travel to certain areas of the country. This was sort of what your whole life was based on. You weren't allowed to move to the city with your family, for example, until you had worked for 10 years continuous employment for the same employer, or else 15 years of continuous employment with different employers. If you didn't have, and then if you had worked for 10 years continuous employment for one employer, then you got what was called a 10-1B status in your passbook, which meant you could bring your family to the city. Otherwise, you had to live in these single-sex hostels, they're called, or dormitory-like facilities, four to a room, very crowded. Thousands of people would live in one of these. It would be for men or for women, who then would return home to see their family for 4 to 6 weeks of the year is all, and the rest of the time they'd be living in these dormitories. It's kind of dark here, but this is one of the segregated beaches that we visited. The only blacks allowed on this beach are the nannies who are taking care of white people's children. Otherwise, it says, under Section 37 of the Durban Beach Bylaws, this bathing area is reserved for the sole use of members of the white race group. So education is an area where the injustice still continues very strongly. About 7 times as much money per student is spent for a white student as for a black student by the South African government. Black schools are typically overcrowded. The education is very much inferior, and that's by intention. In fact, the system of education has been called Bantu education by the government, and blacks were deliberately educated for inferior status in society. This is a Zulu-speaking school. You can see it's real overcrowded, no electricity. This isn't a very good picture, but I put this in because another, probably I think the most vicious feature of the apartheid system is the whole policy of removals. 10% of the population of South Africa has been forcibly moved now, or some 3 million people, mostly blacks, have been moved out of areas that have been declared to be white areas. And on the right here is one of the most amazing individuals that we met with, Bishop Sirota of the Northern Diocese of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa. And I just very innocently one time asked him where he was from, you know, just kind of to make chit-chat. And he looked at me and said, "Barbara, I don't even know where I'm from." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And then he went on to explain how his parents had been had lived in rural northern Transvaal in South Africa, and were one of the first families to become Christians in their area about 100 years ago, or not quite 100 years ago, when the German missionaries first came there, the German Lutheran missionaries. So his family, his grandparents' parents, moved on to the mission station. That was typically what Christians did back then, was move on to the mission station where they lived. His father was a leader in the church. But then, after 1948, when apartheid was declared the official policy of South Africa and the Nationalist Party came into power, that mission station, like so many other Lutheran mission stations, and I'm sure other denominations too, it's just that I know the Lutheran system best, was declared to be what they call a black spot in the midst of a white area, which meant that all the black people had to be moved off of that, their land was taken, and it became a white area. And so his family had to move then, and they moved to a township, a black township outside of Pretoria, which then in 1957 was also declared to be a black spot, as white, the white urban area needed to expand because there were more white people who wanted to live there. They just started declaring the black townships on the periphery to be white areas. All the blacks had to move once again. And so he and his family moved to a very strange part of the Bophuthatswana homeland that really shouldn't be part of that anyway. So now his family lives in one of the homelands, but they're not Swana-speaking people, and so they really are not at home in that homeland. And their life is just this horribly sad tale of having been resettled from one place after another. And that's what has happened for more than 3 million black South Africans, is they've been forcibly resettled or moved, uprooted, and it continues to happen.
To remind you that what we did with the American Indians, moving them around the reservations as we found that we wanted their natural resources that they had.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I think the challenge to us as Americans is that, just what you were saying, because the South African history in many ways is very similar to our own. We visited, this is the Voortrekker Monument, a huge South African monument. It's kind of the national monument. And all around it are these statues of covered wagons, because their history is one like ours of pioneers moving on the frontier, of settling, the pioneers fending off the native peoples, in this case the blacks, in our case the Indians. And they draw a lot of parallels between their situation and ours. They say there's little difference except that you managed to wipe out the Indians with smallpox and various other, all that, whereas the blacks continue to be a majority in southern Africa. But it is a similar history with the whole pioneer mentality and everything. With the additional fact that they believe that God ordained that they were supposed to defeat the African people, the Zulu-speaking people, specifically the Battle of Blood River, and they commemorate that even with the Day of the Covenant, or the vow, when God made a covenant with them to give over those Africans into their hands on December 14th or December 16th. 16th, I think it is. On our trips, what we've done is visit the church and church leaders, especially Lutherans and Lutheran institutions. This is the Lutheran Seminary at Umphumulo in rural Natal in southern South Africa. ALC missionaries serving there are Rolf and Vi Ossing.
Those are friends of mine, Barbara.
Oh, they are.
He was our pastor back in Minnesota.
Huh. Well, he's a New Testament professor there, and she's the librarian.
She's librarian,
We visited with students, some of whom are very outspoken.
This
young man is named Zoe. He's now a pastor and very active in the resistance movement in the church. He's a member of what they would call the Confessing Church movement in South Africa, real courageous. Anyway, he's of course trying to get the South African troops out of Vietnam, or out of Namibia, with this t-shirt here. Delightful person. Visited Kotso House in downtown Johannesburg, where so many of the church agencies are headquartered, including the South African Council of Churches. The United Democratic Front has its offices here. Many other denominations. And you walk in the door, is this beautiful banner here that says Kotso, or peace, in a number of different African languages, and Jesus with these outstretched arms here, a reconciling Jesus, proclaiming peace. And it's just so striking, the contrast to the rest of South Africa, where everywhere you see apartness. That's what apartheid means, is apartness. You see people trying to build up divisions amongst people, whereas Kotso House and the church's headquarters there are trying to work for unity and reconciliation with all these different languages, and a real sense of pulling down barriers where others are trying to erect them. Another agency headquartered there is the Black Sash, which has been the main white opposition organization working since the since the late 1950s against apartheid. It's an organization of white women who work on behalf of people who are having problems with the past laws and are being forced out of their homes. Really dedicated white women. We also visit a bunch of different Lutheran institutions, including this Lutheran Youth Center in Cape Town. Visit with a lot of pastors, a lot of congregational councils, just trying to understand the church situation. We visited with American businesses headquartered in South Africa, too. This was a day we spent with a 3M company, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, which at that time the ALC had a lot of stock in. I think the ALC still holds on to 3M stock. And so we were really debating the whole issue of divestment, and I'd be willing to talk about that if you want. I think we saw some impressive things happening there. This was an integrated lunch. You can see there were two blacks eating with us that day. But overall, still, I am convinced of the importance of American firms getting out of South Africa. Because there's so little they can do in terms of effecting real change. And but we can talk about that if you want to. Here's another ALC missionary, Philip Knutson there on the left, an incredible pastor, with Pastor Tsele on the right. He works in a resettlement area of about 400,000 people, which 5 years ago did not exist. It's called Unverwacht. And it's in a very, very desolate, desert-like area. You can see the conditions there. And his job is to start congregations amongst these people who have been resettled there at Unverwacht. This is his wife, Lou Marie Knutson, on the right, an Afrikaner woman, member of a family that's really resisted apartheid in many ways. But you can see the desert-like terrain there, and then these tin shacks that people live in. The women are really committed to lay ministry, very, very involved, doing the work that pastors do in our country as far as visitation of people, hospital visitation, and things like that. They wear these black and white uniforms and spend at least an afternoon a week doing this volunteer visitation. Real impressive, real challenging to us as far as lay ministry, too.
That's a real witness, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And they go around, they visit the sick. Here they are praying in a hospital with one of the patients. They visit the inactive members. They lead Bible studies. They do all kinds of things. I mean, basically, they do the work of pastors because there is a shortage of pastors in Southern Africa. A pastor would serve maybe 5 to 6 congregations. It's very impressive. And we also spend a lot of time sort of talking and working to understand the whole question of violence and nonviolence in South Africa. This is in the township of Alexandra outside of Johannesburg, where just before we got there in February of 1986, there had been, nobody knows exactly how many people had been killed because there's lots of evidence that the government had suppressed some of the death totals and had actually stolen away bodies so that the families of some of the dead couldn't find the bodies. And but there was probably 40 people killed in some of the worst township violence that had ever happened there. It was at one of these mass funerals when the police began to fire on the crowds. And so this was the cemetery where the victims of that massacre had just been buried a couple weeks earlier, and we sort of paid a visit there. Violence everywhere. One of the people who was instrumental in organizing our visit to Alexandra is this man named, he's not a pastor, Linda Twale, an incredible youth worker with the Lutheran Church who did more to get the kids doing positive stuff in that township than almost anybody else. And we were told that we were perfectly safe with him, and it really seemed to be the case. At that time, it was very dangerous for white people to be going around in Alexandria because of this bitterness against the police who had opened fire on the crowd. And yet, when we were with him, which we were the whole time, we were perfectly safe. People trusted us because they trusted him so much. And we went in his house. Here he is with his wife and some of his kids. And then 2 weeks after we got back, we learned that his house had been bombed. And he sent us these photos. This is that same place, the same kitchen. Probably blown up by people supportive of the township government, which he was very much involved in opposing. And here he is with the pastor standing in front of his bombed out house there. So that really brought it home to us how much violence there is, how dangerous it really is to be working for the church, to be working against apartheid. This is a photo of a demonstration some years ago. People still try to demonstrate, although the government has so effectively clamped down with laws opposing any kind of outdoor demonstration of any kind of outdoor meeting even, that it's very, very difficult to resist nonviolently. The crackdown has been pretty intense. And so the whole question now is, what is the future for South Africa? What will there be peaceful change? Will change and a move towards a more just society happen in the next few years? Or will it be an all-out civil war like Lebanon or so many other places where, you know, chaos is reigning? And I really do believe that it's our job as Christians to work in every way to see that just change happens as nonviolently as possible. I think there's a lot we can do for that. And nonviolence does not mean copping out on the situation, but rather really, really working now before time runs out, and it is running out, to implement significant changes, not just reforms, but very significant changes to transform the South African situation. And I think there's a lot that we as Americans can do to make that happen. Another place we visited that brought home the violence is the Phoenix Center, which was Mahatma Gandhi's home when he lived in South Africa, which I had never realized until the movie Gandhi came out, but he was from South Africa. This was one of his great-great-granddaughters there. This was the museum in his former boyhood home. And this, too, has now been burned by, I think, some blacks who were committing violence against the Asian community there. So it is violence within the black community also. Just a few slides here of Namibia, because I think that that is a specific task that we as American Lutherans really need to take on, is working for independence for Namibia. It's a colony of South Africa, occupied illegally by South Africa, clearly illegally. Everyone in the world has declared it to be illegal, and still South Africa persists in staying there. A terrible war is going on in the north. We took an airplane up to the north into the war zone to visit the Ovambo Kavango Lutheran Church and saw so much of the suffering that people are undergoing because of the war, which continues to escalate.
Isn't that the author of the book on the right, Holden
Village? Yes, that's Charles P. Lutz there on the right. Very involved in Holden, wrote Surprising Gift, and he was on this trip that I was on also in 1986. Here, for example, is Bishop Dumeni, the bishop of the Ovambo Kavango Church, standing next to the bombed-out printing press. Three times the church printing press has been blown up by South African troops, and three times it's been rebuilt through the help of the Lutheran World Federation. But the last time, they decided to just leave the bombed-out presses standing where they were as a sort of monument to the horror of violence. And so here we are, you know, walking in the midst of those printing presses. What is it that they were printing that was considered so subversive that it had to be blown up? It was things like Luther's catechism in the Ovambo language, hymn books, Bibles, and then the church paper, which is the only independent paper in northern Namibia, which did print news of the war. When people were victims of torture and stuff, the newspaper would print it, and that's why they blew it up. Here we are meeting with some other leaders there. In the hospital, it's really impressive the kind of care that people receive at this hospital. It was built for 120 patients, but now has more than 400 patients there. A Lutheran-run hospital. And people go there rather than to the government hospital because they trust the staff and they trust the care they're receiving. And to visit the church service is just amazing. The singing, the worship, the vitality of the faith. This was a processional offering. They were having a contest that day, so the boys came up and gave their offering first and the girls next, and they counted it, and a real sort of festive atmosphere. I got to preach. That was really exciting. Translated into Oshivambo. We also met with government leaders there in Namibia, and this was the Administrator General of Namibia, South Africa's highest ranking government official in Namibia. we asked for some very specific things, such as release of certain church leaders who were prisoners at that time, an end to some of the violence against church workers, and especially the violence on the part of the secret organization called Kufut, or Crowbar, which is the most notoriously violent. He was sympathetic and listened. I think we all appreciated, he was very much a gentleman. We all appreciated being able to talk with him. But pretty adamant that the SWAPO people, which is the group fighting against the South African forces in the north, he says the SWAPO people are communists. And the church leaders say that they're not. And that was the impasse that we simply could not get past. The Lutheran Church even has been accused of being a SWAPO church because so many of its members are SWAPO members. Our government, President Reagan and Secretary of State George Shultz and Undersecretary of State for African Affairs Chester Crocker would like us to believe that SWAPO is communist, but we simply did not find that to be the case. And it was very sad to see how the U.S. is contributing more and more support to the new Contras in Angola, to Jonas Savimbi and his forces, which are clearly South African-backed, as they try to wipe out SWAPO bases in Angola. But anyway, we had to just agree to disagree on this. We also met with the white Lutheran church leaders, which was significant because these churches had been suspended from the Lutheran World Federation at the 1984 assembly in Budapest, Hungary. And it looks like there's going to be some movement towards change on their part, so that at least the Namibian white Lutheran church will be merging with the black churches and will thus become a member again of the Lutheran World Federation. They really are moving. The South African white churches are not, but the Namibian churches are. We visited the offices of the Namibian Council of Churches, which had been bombed out several months earlier. Here's Abisai Shiavali showing some of the damage to. On the left is Bishop Dave Brown of the Holden Board, Iowa Bishop, and Wes Haugen of North Dakota on the right there, two of the bishops in our group. Here's Dave Brown taking communion from Bishop Dumaney. It was really powerful to conclude the trip with this communion service where people really share themselves with us, share their hopes and dreams for the future of their country, and we vowed to work to help bring that about, to do what we could to work for independence for Namibia. Okay, that's all the slides. Just want to show a map here of the removals in South Africa, because I think graphically this shows better than anything else kind of the scope that we're talking about. And I would say that is probably the most demonic thing happening. It's hard to know which is more demonic. The other thing would be the violence against children. I mean, it really is incredible the number of kids who are in detention, have been tortured, whose whereabouts is unknown, and they seem to be victims most of all of the crackdown that's been going on now for more than 2 years, since 1985. But anyway, the other thing is animals and this whole business of who owns the land. 4.5 million whites. This is South Africa here. 4.5 million whites own all the land that's yellow on here, including all the major urban areas, all the good land, all the land where the best mines are. And these little splotches of color are the homelands. How many are independent? I can't remember if Kwan Dabele has become independent or not. But anyway, several of which have been declared independent by the South African government, and the rest are scheduled for independence. And you look at the geography of it, and it's simply, maybe we can stick it up here. That's a good point. It's ridiculous. This is considered to be the most viable one right here. Boputatswana is the name of it. We visited there. It's these seven separate bits of land here, including this one way down here, that's supposed to be a country. South Africa would like the world to believe that these are countries, because then they can take away those people's South African citizenship and instead give them citizenship in Boputatswana. So ultimately the goal is that there will be no blacks who are citizens of South Africa. That was the master plan. It's obviously not going to be able to be implemented, but that's what they're trying for. And you ask them, well, how can a country with these seven separate pieces be considered a viable country? You know, why don't you at least give them the land in between? Well, there's obviously good land in there that they don't want to give them. What they say, and we asked some of the South African officials about this, what they say is, well, there's a lot of island countries in the world. Look at Indonesia, look at the Philippines, look at Japan. Countries that are separate pieces of land, and they're viable. And then you just kind of think, but those island countries have water in between. You know, it's not a deal like this with land in between. They call it the Bophuthatswana Archipelago. I mean, they use island-like language, but it's not an island. And that's considered to be the most viable. This one, KwaZulu here, is 47 separate pieces of land, the turquoise stuff. But as you drive through, you can just see the valleys, the unfertile land. That's KwaZulu. The top, the smooth part where sugarcane can grow, that's Natal, the white area. It's just real striking. This is Benta up here where Pastor Pirasani is from. None of these homelands are very viable. And the red arrows on here indicate large-scale removals, historic removals, where it's like Bishop Sirota's family being moved off the mission station, where they would take a whole community and uproot them and move them into one of these homelands out of a white area, an area that's been designated white. And that's happened to some 3 million people now, and it's still happening. A lot of removals are still going on.
Where is the
sutra
there?
Here, right here. It's a set, because that is considered a separate country by the world, that one's not marked on here, but it's right here. And here's Swaziland. These are all kind of independent countries in Botswana. They're frontline states that are very much under the thumb of South Africa, but they're not in the same category as the homeland. Okay, thanks. So anyway, and this map is put out by the Black Sash, that organization of white women that I was telling you about that really has done a lot to oppose apartheid. The churches have been very slow to respond to the whole situation, but more and more now there is some resistance even within the Dutch Reformed Church. In fact, right now in South Africa there's probably more resistance within the white Dutch Reformed Church than there is within the white Lutheran Church. You can almost give up on the white Lutheran Church. It's very, very sad. We met with a bunch of white Lutherans in South Africa, and they're like Nazis, really. I mean, they are further to the right than the Nationalist Party, most of them. They're rural farmers, very, very conservative. One thing that's come out in the last couple of years is the Kairos document, which is a very significant theological piece. Steve DeGrucci was up here on our teaching staff in June doing sessions on this. That basically is a devastating critique both of state theology, which should be the official apartheid doctrine that the state has built up, and also a critique of church theology, which would be the typical theology of most of the churches in South Africa, not of justifying apartheid, but of sort of accommodating themselves to it. And instead calls for a prophetic theology, a genuinely prophetic theology that speaks out against the system and works in all kinds of different ways for significant change. And this was a widely heralded document when it came out. Still is, very significant. Just a couple other resources, and then when you want to open it up for discussion. In our bookstore, we've got some good stuff on South Africa, I think. We've got a number of things by Bishop Tutu and Alan Bosak. Here's a book by Tutu. There's another one by him also. Let's see, I've got one of the Bosak books here, The Finger of God. These are two books of sermons by some real prominent black theologians. We also normally carry, we're out of this one now. I would say, though, that this one is probably the best book to come out on South Africa in recent years, Move Your Shadow by Joseph Lelyfeld of the New York Times. We'll be getting this back in the bookstore now in paperback. Excellent, excellent insight into the whole South African situation. Not from a church perspective, but just from a journalist perspective. Excellent writing. This one, the Mission to South Africa Report of the Commonwealth Group, is a real devastating critique of apartheid that was written in late 86. It's still very much up to date and real good. Then we've got a number of books by John DeGrucci. I forgot to bring The Church Struggle in South Africa. That's a real classic as far as the telling about the whole church situation in Southern Africa. He also has a new one now on Bonhoeffer and South Africa. And then this little one I really like. This is a book of worship resources. Cry Justice. It's prayers, meditations, and readings from South Africa, and songs also, little prayers, scripture quotes. And to me, this is some of the most powerful stuff now coming out of South Africa. I told you I really would say that I was kind of converted by African Christians. And their prayers and songs really, really continue to move me. I think that's that we, as Western Christians, if we want to survive, if we want to grow in our faith, we really need to listen to the voices of African and Latin American Christians now as they're speaking to us, speaking God's word to us in some really powerful ways. I read the quote the other night from Bishop Tutu as part of Vespers. I think I'll just repeat a little bit of that because it talked about something that we can do, and that is pray for South Africans. He just says, we know in our, this is to an American audience now, we know in our experience what it is meant to be upheld by the love and prayers and concern of so many around the world. It has been almost a physical sensation, this being borne up by your servant prayers. A woman's home is going to be demolished tomorrow. The churches, the clinics, and the schools have already been demolished. The water supply has been stopped. This is the removal stuff that happens all the time. The bus service has been interrupted. So that, as the government puts it, the people will move voluntarily. And this woman whose home is going to be demolished tomorrow sets out to pray. She says, God, thank you for loving us. How can that be except that you here have prayed her into that state of grace? So he really feels that our prayers are very, very important. One of the most significant ways we can work to bring about change. Obviously not the only one, but really powerful. Anyway, those are some suggestions on resources and hopefully at least a look at some of the issues going on. And let's open it up now. Here are your comments, questions, whatever.
Could you talk about divestment?
All right. Actually, it becomes less and less of an issue now, ironically, as South Africa becomes a worse and worse investment climate. Probably no pension fund, no responsible investor would invest in South Africa right now anyway. Even looking at the economic considerations, it's too unstable. But I still think it's a really powerful way that we can express opposition to apartheid. It obviously has problems. Many critics, including some leading white South Africans, Alan Payton, Helen Suzman of the opposition party, say that it's going to hurt blacks more than it's going to hurt whites, and they oppose it. But a number of blacks with real strong credentials are in favor of it, including Bishop
Hey,
Tutu.
Get back away from that, Randy. Thank you.
Not really.
Excuse me.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I agree. Blacks are not free to speak out really against or to speak in favor of divestment. It's illegal. It's considered treason. But privately, most of the black leaders with whom we talked, even some of the employees at 3M, it was really interesting when we really got their trust a little bit and asked them, now, what do you think? Do you really think that 3M should be here? Do you really think we should own stock in this company? What? Then they said, no. It shouldn't be here because it supports the system, and there's a perception that American businesses give legitimation to the apartheid system. And even if you integrate the workplace, even if you pay fair wages at the workplace, still the black workers go home to Soweto and the white workers go home to Johannesburg, and there's nothing any American company could do about that unless they're willing to do civil disobedience. And I would have a lot of respect for an American corporation that would do that, that would house their workers together in defiance of the laws and would say, this is how it has to be if we're going to be here. But none have done that, mm-hmm. that I know of. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the blacks do most of the labor in South Africa. And I would assume there are a large number of black unions representing black workers. And it would seem to me they would possibly hold the key to power in South Africa. Are the black unions doing anything to non-violently advance the cause of the black?
Yeah, they're doing a lot. I think most people would say the unions and the churches are the only two possible hope. Well, the United Democratic Front is a coalition, but most unions and many church groups are members of that. Yeah, it's severely restricted what they can do, but yeah, they have significantly gotten involved in the struggle for meaningful change.
Are they having any success then?
I'd say some of the labor practices really have changed. Now, one problem, and this is why you have to use the word relative affluence and relative poverty in speaking about the situation of whites and blacks in South Africa, because I have traveled in other parts of Africa also, and there's no question but what economically blacks in South Africa are better off than blacks in many parts of Africa. So one problem, labor-wise, is that there are the people in all the frontline states, Botswana, Mozambique, even Zimbabwe, some of the other countries really want to work in South Africa because labor conditions, the wages and stuff would be better there. So the unions have that kind of pressure also, that the employers can hire guest workers from other countries. And I do think that, I mean, one has to be honest and say economically blacks are better off, but in a lot of ways, except in the homelands where the infant mortality rate and stuff and the food situation really is very bad. But the problem with apartheid is not so much economic as it is political, the lack of freedom, lack of human rights of any kind for blacks.
Bart, can you say something about the black-on-black violence in the ghettos and that sort of thing?
Well, interestingly enough, I was just reading in the Commonwealth report this afternoon, and they quote a number of sources. They think this was a group of, you know who the Commonwealth is. It's Great Britain and all their former colonies that are now, their friends. They all, like Canada and stuff. They sent 8 representatives to South Africa to really study the situation in 1986. They strongly feel that a lot of the black-on-black violence is funded by the government, that the government pays blacks to attack other blacks, which I had certainly heard but didn't know how much credence to give to that. And I was surprised to hear it really claimed to be that in this volume. The blacks disagree. And there certainly are different ethnic groups among the blacks. Now, I would say that they're equally strong amongst the whites, that the division between Afrikaners and English-speaking whites is as strong as any division amongst the blacks in South Africa. But there are different language groups, different ethnic backgrounds. There's the Zulu-speaking peoples, the largest. There's the Tswanas, the Sutus. And they don't always agree either within groups or between groups, and the government is very, very good at enhancing any tensions there are between those groups. There's also tensions among urban versus rural blacks. The blacks who do decide to collaborate with the system in township governments, at any level of what most blacks would call the puppet government, are usually the ones who are attacked by other blacks, often in some very brutal ways, including the notorious necklacing and stuff like that. One of the strongest tensions is between the United Democratic Front and Inkatha, which is Gacha Buthelezi's Zulu-speaking outfit. Gacha Buthelezi is kind of the darling of the Reagan administration. He is touted as being the true leader of South African blacks, as opposed to Bishop Tutu and Nelson Mandela, who aren't really the true leaders. And he is a leader. Gacha Buthelezi has a following. He's against divestment. He's a much more conservative person, issue-wise, and is responsible for a lot of violence against UDF supporters and others.
You mentioned that one pastor is alive and out of jail because of all the pressure put on by the Americans. Well, that's how Bishop Tutu got to the National Council of Churches meeting in World Council of Churches. He was supposed to be a mainline speaker, and they wouldn't let him out of Africa, so they gave him a special permit, which he was absolutely indignant about. He said, can you imagine? They gave me
a permit, not even a passport, out of my own country. And it was wounding, but 1,000 people met him at the airport in the middle of the night. Finally did get away 3 days later.
Yeah, South Africa is really sensitive to world opinion. I think that's a very important role that we can play. They consider themselves to be a Western nation, a civilized nation, and they want to appear civilized and Western. And so they don't want us to find out about all the brutality and stuff like that. There still are, as far as I know, 4 Lutheran pastors in jail, including Pastor Tsela, a real neat man who has a ministry in Soweto, and a lot of other church leaders, Roman Catholic, United Methodist, United Church of Christ, whose names I can give you if you want to write letters on their behalf. We did that during the Holden Winter Community here. We wrote on behalf of Pastor Ferrisani and some of the others. And as far as I know, nobody else is out. So there's a lot of work to be done there, too. Yeah, our pressure can really make a difference.
I just like to tell a really funny story about that. Dr. C. Edward Crowther was the Anglican Bishop of Kimberley in South Africa and was expelled because of his anti-apartheid activities. And he was expelled in a rush. He didn't get to go home to take any of his own things or anything. He left with his clerics. All he had, I mean, he was in his all then, stoles and everything. And they put him on a plane to get him out, and they were very embarrassed about kicking him out of the country and his clerics. And the police weren't going to put him on the plane with his clerics on because they didn't want anybody to take pictures of him. Mm-hmm. They said, you have to go, put clothes on. He said, you didn't give me a chance to get any clothes. You've got to take that off. He said, okay. And then he was going to get on the plane in his undershirt.
Okay.
I'll take it off. And then they wouldn't let him do that either. So that's how he left. But yeah, they're so sensitive to the appearances of that.
Yeah, but there is a real effective crackdown right now, has been for more than a year, on news coming out of South Africa and stuff. The newspapers are not allowed to report any violence happening. You'll always see in the New York Times, for example, I think in almost any newspaper now, you'll see the little disclaimer, this was approved by the South African censors or whatever. I mean, just to remind us, this isn't the truth. This isn't what they would print if they had any freedom to print anything else. And so the most effective weapon we can use against the whole system is to try to find out what really is going on and then let people know, I mean, to tell what truly is the situation. And then to work, to do what we can to stop. Well, it's almost 5:00 here, so we should probably end, but I'd be happy to answer any more questions that you might have or hear your comments. Thanks.